Why do poor countries remain poor? So here's what we're going to do today, and then here's what we're going to do next Sunday. I would like to give a sweep of the world, of what we've seen, and just give you a little taste. And that this is going to be global, and then we'll do a Q&A. And just ask any questions you want about any country that you want, and we'll do it that way. Then next Sunday, I would like to come and focus much more on the United States, of who we are, what we are, where we're going, and where this is all leading. We're going to do a big update on this on January 21. We will do the annual economic outlook at Scottsdale Bible Church. January 21, that's a Thursday night. That is a little bit later than we usually do it, but to try to line up my schedule with the auditorium was really something this year. And I'll just say this to you. I would be so delighted if you would come on January 21, but only come if you would bring a non-Christian with you. Because the big idea of January 21 is outreach, outreach. That's what we want it to be, an outreach. And I'm going to work harder on that outreach. That outreach will only last about 20 minutes long. But I'm going to work harder on that outreach than anything I'll do all year long. So I guarantee I'm not going to come in and do that one by the seat of my pants. I want to prepare, be ready, and then just be praying, praying, praying that God is going to use it in a special way. There's some impressions that you can make as you see the various continents of the world as far as why do poor people remain poor. In Africa, to the best that Wayne and I can come up with, poor people remain poor because first and foremost, they are a tribal continent, a tribal group of people. And when you're tribal, the tribe leader is really the spokesman for God. That's as close as you can get to God as being the tribal leader. So the tribal leader, it's a command and control, and it's top down. And so everything has to go through that tribal leader. So there isn't freedom as you and I know it. There isn't individualism as you and I know it. There isn't private ownership of the means of production as you and I know it. It all goes to trouble. So that's a huge, huge problem. And so that's why when you go to Africa, we will spend a good deal of our time in the book and in Africa talking about God, who God is. In the beginning, God. No, God here. This is God. Here's his creation, the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars. What is man that thou art mindful of him? The son of man that thou dost care about him. You've created him just a little bit lower than the angels and yet given him dominion over everything on the earth. But whatever that is, that's different than God. God is. God is the great I am. And so tribalism can get it all backwards right out of the chute. Then it gets property wrong right out of the chute. And it was John Locke who said in 1688 that when a country is wrong about property, it's wrong on about everything. So it's some bad luck in the sense of a north-south continent and some bad luck in the fact that there's just pretty much fresh food all the way through. And so you don't have to be like an Iowa corn farmer and work your face off and grow 100 acres of corn and then put it in a corn crib and then have it stored and then have it sent to the manufacturer. And the way it works in Africa is you just go and eat the fresh fruit and go and shoot the meat and eat fresh food all the time, never really having to think about tomorrow and next year. And so that's a given in Africa, and all of a sudden that begins to twist things around. It's really a culture where the women do all the work and the men do all the sitting around, and that's backwards. So as we talk about the various continents of the world, every single one of them has their own individualized situations that sometimes it just takes a little bit and they can begin to flip around. In 1988, to go to Ireland and meet with Prime Minister Charles Haughey, Ireland was the poorest country in Western Europe in 1988, and say, you know, Prime Minister, if you would lower the corporate tax rate, if you would lower the marginal tax rate, if you would lower the capital gains tax, and if you would get rid of the double taxation dividends, you'd all of a sudden give Ireland incentive to produce and create and get wealthy. And for whatever reason, Haughey bought into it, lowered the corporate tax rate from 30 to 15, blah, 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 and Ireland goes from the poorest country in Western Europe to the richest country in Western Europe. So sometimes there's just a little niche that you can make and you can turn a poor country into a rich country. Most of the time, however, it's much, much more complicated, complicated than that. In Latin America, you listen to this scene. Garcia is president of Peru in the 1980s. He single-handedly destroys Peru in the 1980s. In the 1980s, listen to this, you're not going to believe it, you're going to think I'm making it up. In the 1980s, under Garcia, four straight years of 2,500% rates of inflation per year. 2,500% rates of inflation per year. You know what I've just said? You've destroyed the economy. That's what I've just said. You've single-handedly destroyed. There's nothing left. And there was nothing left of Peru. He destroyed it. He then gets thrown in jail. He gets out of prison. He moves to Bolivia. He lives in Bolivia 6 years. He comes back to Peru and gets elected president. Guess who's the president of Peru right now? Garcia. Now, here's the problem. Here's the problem. Is he is so typical of all that's going on in Latin America. They don't care about the people. They care about the top 5%. The top 5% own all the land. The top 5% have all the power. The top 5% have all the money. This is typical in Mexico. This is true in Brazil. This is true in Argentina. This is true in Peru. It's so Latin America, I can't believe it. There might be a few exceptions. One exception is Chile. Our think tank's been down there since the early 80s. I'll tell you all about Chile at a later time. But a few exceptions, but I'm telling you. Latin America, they're leaders. So when you meet with them, does it bother you that half the people don't have electricity and there's lots of hunger and they don't have fresh water? And the first 10 or 15 people that Wayne and I met in Peru didn't have any front teeth. Everybody had rotten teeth, but no front teeth. Do you care? Do you care? And it just seems that most of the time, from Latin Americans' perspective, the government really doesn't care, only except for the top 5%. And then, again, some kind of bad luck. Bad luck in the sense that you have this Amazon River coming down from the Andes and running out to the sea. It's not the Mississippi. The Mississippi is a slow-moving river. This is coming out of 20,000 feet. And so the Amazon River is rolling at twice the rate, if not three times the rate, as the Mississippi. That's problem number one. It's very dangerous. Problem number two is anybody that falls into the Amazon River, you're dead. You're dead. A whole busload of people went in the Amazon River. In 5 minutes, 53 people were eaten by snakes. The snakes in the Amazon River have heads this big. Have you ever seen the anacondas? So that Amazon River is anything but friendly. Whereas in America, we think of the Missouri and the Mississippi and slow moving and no. What a bummer, in that sense. Albania has some of the most beautiful beaches in the whole world. There's no hotels built. There's no access to them. Why? Property rights. No one can get property rights, and so nothing is done with... Am I going to stumble over that, Ed? Nothing is done with beaches. America, right, likes to do things with their beaches, whether it be in Hawaii or any other place. Asia, look at Japan is the only country in the world that really was able to create a miracle without a strong God underpinning. But the way Japan and a good part of Asia bypass that problem is they know that if they can make work the religion, good things happen economically when you work hard, when you save, when you invest, and you work 24 hours a day. Good things happen to societies that work. And so, but even when you work hard, look at the Chinese have been hard workers for 5,000 years. Where are they today? Well, thanks for asking. Today, about an annual per capita income of $4,000 or $5,000. That's where China is today. Growing, yes, but still annual income of $4,000 or $5,000. As compared to the United States, $44,000. As compared to Singapore, $41,000. As compared to Taiwan, $33,000. As compared to Hong Kong, $43,000. China. So working hard isn't always going to get it done either. And yet, what a bummer in one sense to be born Chinese. First of all, Chinese, one dynasty after another. Each of the dynasties, the head of the dynasty, that's God incarnate. That's who you worship. That's who makes all the decisions. Therefore, no distribution of property. All property is going to be made by the dynasty leader. It goes for thousands of years like that. The Chinese are smart. The Chinese are the best engineers in the world. The Chinese are the best mathematicians in the world. So they have all the ingredients, but there they are, 5,000 bungling years. And then, to top it all off, in the 20th century, communism and Mao Zedong gets a hold of China and really destroys it. Because communism and socialism is just backwards. Communism and socialism says the abolition of private property. John Locke says, no, private ownership is the precursor for freedom, and freedom is the mainspring of economic prosperity. So you couldn't find two more diametrically opposed systems than communism and socialism over here, and John Locke and capitalism and free markets and individualism and freedom over here. And so now the Chinese have to live through this nonsense for almost the whole 20th century. Yes, India became a democracy in 1950. But I got to tell you, democracies do not produce prosperity. Our forefathers, our founding fathers, were scared to death of democracy. They knew that democracy... James Madison, who wrote most of the Constitution of the United States, said, we've designed this government to protect freedom from democracy and the individual from the majority. Our founding fathers were clear. They said it. Democracy is simply two wolves and one sheep voting on what we're going to have for dinner. So they were clear on democracy. India goes democracy in 1950. Proves nothing. India says state poor and is poor. What's going on there? Well, they went democracy, but they decided to follow the Soviet communist Moscow plan. And so the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, India is all following socialism and Moscow communism and five-year plans and seven-year plans and command and control and top-down and rules and regulations. And so you have 1.1 billion people starving to death over there in India. You have 1.3 billion people almost starving to death there in China. That's the bad news. The good news is life changes. The good news is our think tank, along with the Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal, we monitor 165 countries around the world. We monitor them on called the Index of Economic Freedom on 10 economic variables. How are they doing as far as inflation, high or low? How are they doing as far as trade, high tariffs or low tariffs? How are they doing on the size of government, big or small? How are they doing on regulation? Is government over-regulating the economy, or are the regulations reasonable? How are they doing on privatization? How are they doing on corruption? How are they doing on private property? How are they doing on giving titles and deeds and articles of incorporation and getting capitalism electrified? How are they doing? How are they doing? So we've measured these 165 countries for the last 20 years. 20 years ago, 17 out of 165 countries were free or mostly free. In 2009, 87 countries are free or mostly free. Two quick examples, China and India. Mao Zedong finally dies. Deng Xiaoping takes over China. One would have expected Deng Xiaoping to follow in the line of this great communist, Mao Zedong, but instead, he's in office 10 days, and he had decided while watching Mao Zedong that socialism and communism doesn't work. He decided that he just saw collectivization of agriculture destroy the farmers. He decided that top-down command and control what just didn't seem to create any kind of wealth. Deng Xiaoping decided that central authority was a problem. So he's only in office 10 days, and in 1977 or 78, Deng Xiaoping says, we are going to give 30-year leases on the land, which is now changed to 50-year leases, which is now changed to 70-year leases on land. Hey, 70-year lease on land? That's communism? I thought communism was about the abolition of private property and put it all under the hands of the state. No, Deng Xiaoping says we're going to get it into the hands of the people and give 70-year leases. And all of a sudden, Chinese agriculture started coming out of its doldrums. And all of a sudden, people in China were allowed to move and live in the home they wanted to live. And all of a sudden, people in China were allowed. And so if you had to describe China today, here would be my best description. Beijing is going out to any one of the 175 cities of over a million each and saying to those cities, we can't build your hospitals, we can't build your schools, we can't build your roads, we can't do your infrastructure. You do it and charge for it. And so if you folks out there in the hinterland think you need a 2 miles of oiled road, build one and then charge people if they're going to use it. People are delighted to use those roads. And so what I'm saying is China is privatizing from the ground up. The communist government knows this is going on, but on the other hand, they also know that everybody's starving to death under that system. So let's give 70-year leases on land. Let's allow people to get titles and deeds and articles of incorporation. Let's privatize from the ground up, and all of a sudden, China goes from 1.3 billion people in absolute poverty to only 600 or 700 million people in absolute poverty. 300 or 400 million people in the last 20 years have climbed out of poverty in China because they're starting to do some correct things economically. This is not to say, to minimize at all the effects in both India and in China of the underground and above ground Christian church. I got to tell you, that Americans have been sending Bibles into India for 40 years. I'm going to tell you something. There's probably more Bibles in India than there are in America. And I'm going to tell you that when countries begin to figure out that God is God and I am not, and God is a sovereign God, and He's the one that says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not onto your own understanding, but in everything, give adherence to Him, and He will direct your paths. And you begin to read truth. The Bible speaks truth into people. The Bible says, thou shalt not steal. Wait a minute. If it says, thou shalt not steal, it must assume that you own it. Ah, really? You mean ownership is sanctified by the Word of God? Absolutely. Thou shalt not steal. The 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. So when the Bible starts speaking truth into people, all of a sudden their societies begin to change. Wayne and I are both hopeful for India, for China, and for Africa. Because the fact of the matter is, there's probably more Christians in China today than are Christians in the United States. And it's a thriving church because it's a persecuted church. And a persecuted church just seems to just make it happen for whatever reason. Africa, Christianity is growing unbelievably in Africa. India, like I say, we've probably sent more Bibles than any other place. So we're hopeful. We always want to start with the spiritual. We always want to start, men and women are created in the image of God. Individuals have dignity. Individuals have worth. Individuals have uniqueness bestowed on them by God. And when we talk about America next week, the way we state it is we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. Endowed by our Creator. Not endowed by government. Not endowed by politics. Not endowed by economics. Not endowed by wealth. Not endowed by the intellect. No, no. In Americans, we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And so it's beautiful. What will happen to a society when that becomes a thought? God is God. I am not. He's sovereign. He's the Creator. He's the one that gives us transcendent truth. If you do not have transcendent truth, you have nothing. Where is truth? There is no truth. Just because I say, honor your father and mother, why should you listen to that? Just because I say, thou shalt not commit adultery, why should you listen to that? That's just one idea. But when God says it, when you have true truth, transcendent truth, it begins to truly, truly change a nation. So Wayne and I are the feeling that unless we really get it really solid as to what the spiritual background of this nation is, and we move into that area, we've accomplished nothing. But after that, then, we say, hey, there are some things in economics. I mean, economists a lot of times make life way, way too simple. And so let me give you one of my most simplistic statements that you will ever hear in your whole life. Any country can choose prosperity if it wants to. Any country can choose prosperity if it wants to. If it privatizes, deregulates, stabilizes the currency, lowers tariffs, moves to free trade, adopts property rights so that people can get access to property, own property, and build up collateral so that they can go to a bank and borrow $200. Why can I borrow $200? Because look, I have a title to this home, I build up some collateral to this home, and you will loan me the $200 because you have collateral to back them. Unless you electrify capitalism, you cannot make it work. So you've got to have that right. And so the point is, you do some of those things, none the least to say, understand that, O Lord, how wonderful is your name. You've created the sun and the moon and the stars. You've created us. You know every detail about our lives. You know when we stand up and when we sit down. You know every word we're going to speak before we even speak a word. I cannot hide from you. A darkness, I cannot get away from you. Even then, you are there. You made me in my mother's womb. You know every detail of my life. God, that's the God. God, you know every day that I'm going to live before I've even lived the day. My days are absolutely numbered, and you know them right to the second. That's the God. So if you don't start the spiritual, you don't get it right. But if you don't add some of the economics, you can't get it right either. And then if you don't get some of the things right as far as government, you don't get it right either. Because I've got to tell you, Western Europe started becoming an economic success. And by the way, the first place in the world, in the history of the world, where we saw any economic growth. We go from the beginning of time, ground level zero, Adam and Eve, and we move through thousands and thousands and thousands of years, no economic growth, and finally we begin to see economic growth in Western Europe. Why? Why? Thanks for asking. Well, Europe, in those foundations, it was by and large Christian. By and large Christian. And Christianity and the Bible is speaking truth into people's lives. And when they speak, when it speaks truth into people's lives, in 1215, they signed the Magna Carta. Now, why would a government ever agree to sign that, the Magna Carta? That is, take power away from government. That is, we're going to have a rule of law. No, no, Mr. King. No, no, Miss Queen. You can't do anything you want to. You both live under a much higher power than you, believe it or not. And it is God. And you will live under this higher power, and there will be rule of law. And when you pass laws, you, the king and the court, have to come under those laws too, not just all us people out here in the hinterland, but you too. So the Magna Carta, Christian-driven. Martin Luther in 1517 pounds the thesis on the Wittenberg door in Germany. Look, this is no time to debate right now, Catholicism and Protestantism, but let's just say one thing about these two kind of fundamentally different systems. Protestantism says save, work, invest. No kidding. No kidding. And, oh, by the way, when you save and work and invest, you're doing God's word. God's work. Business for the glory of God. All of a sudden, we say, oh, no, 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 you can only give glory to God if you're a person of the cloth and you have to be a priest or you have to be an elder. No, no, no. No, we're all instruments in God's hands. Business for the glory of God. So is it any wonder that Protestantism begins to change Western Europe? John Locke, writing from Oxford, freedom, freedom, freedom. Freedom is the mainspring of economic prosperity. Freedom is a virus for which there is no antidote. Freedom is a country's best investment. So you have this great writer out of Oxford writing. Locke, a Christian, all from Christian presuppositions. Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, same thing. The book that he wrote right before his book, The Wealth of Nations, was called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, a spiritual book. So Europe was spiritually and Christian delivered, and so for the first time in the world, you begin to see some economic growth. So it was easy then for the founding fathers to open up this country 232 years ago. The Magna Carta under one arm, the writings of John Locke under the other. Most of them were by and large Protestant and understood something about Martin Luther and savings and investment and hard work. And obviously, Adam Smith wrote his book in 1776, the year that America declared its freedom, the Declaration of Independence in 1776. And so no wonder, we were all set. We were all set. All our founding fathers had to do then is figure out how to circumscribe government. How are we going to write a constitution where government power is delegated? How are we going to set up a system where the legislative, executive, and judicial branches can balance each other off? Well, we're going to talk about that next week. Limited government. And wham, it works. It works. So, so the politicians have some things to do. Get off of business back. I'll never forget the first time I went to Romania and got to be with the president of the country, President Iliescu, talk to him about what? Why are you making it so hard for Romanians to get into business? Garcia in Peru, the same way. Every country we go to, it's the same way. To open up a two-man shop of anything. This license, and this government procedure, and this government requirement, and this certificate, and this, and this, and this. In Tanzania, you have to go through 21 agencies to open up a little shop. And each one of those you have to pay a payoff to. And so it costs you thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And all you want to do is just open up a little two-man donut shop. And governments will not let you do it. That's called regulation. My word is called, let's deregulate. If I could become the president of Mexico, even for 5 minutes, we could make a difference. We would say, all rules and laws inhibiting entrepreneurs, null and void. Over. Mexico, why are you doing this? Why are you making it so hard? All these people want to do is work and produce and create. And oh, by the way, they will pay taxes. Please, why do you overregulate them like this? Okay, I'm done. Because I want to talk about what you want to talk about and raise any questions you want about one of the continents of the world, and we'll make a shot at this. Yes. Speak up, sir. We better wait.
You talked about the development of Western Europe being the first. How do you account for example, the Roman and Greek civilizations, which I think were quite successful at one time?
The Roman and Greek civilization were only successful for the top tier. Everybody else lived like dogs. And oh, by the way, in both Greek and Roman civilizations, at least one-third of those were slaves, living strongly on slaves. Hey, you can build pyramids if you want to. If you've got millions and millions of slaves that you'll sacrifice, you can build a great wall across China, 6,000 miles long, over century after century after century. Go ahead, build it. There'll be tens of millions of lives caught in that wall, and so on. But Roman and Greeks, a number of things. First of all, Romans and Greeks had no idea what freedom even meant. I mean, freedom is about lack of coercion. No coercion. That's what freedom. For you to have the home you want, the job you want, work for what you want, save what you want, have the kind of family that you want, blah, blah, blah. No coercion. Oh, coercion? Give me a break. There was no concept of a limited government, no concept of freedom. Great on democracy. So we're happy for the Greeks and the Romans for giving us that whole concept of democracy. But you heard me say 10 minutes ago, democracy does not produce prosperity. I just told you that India was a democracy from 1950, and it wasn't until 1991 that the Prime Minister of India says, enough is enough, enough is enough. I don't think we can go on like this anymore. 1.1 billion people starving under Roman, Greek philosophy and democracy. And so Prime Minister Singh in India says, you know what? Here's the deal. Everywhere I go in the world, Indians get rich. I go to San Francisco, they're the richest demographic group. I go to Cape Town, South Africa, they're the richest demographic group. I go to Kenya, and Indians from India are producing 70% of the wealth in Kenya. Everywhere I go, I see Indians succeed and prosper, except in one country, India. What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this Greek and Roman philosophy of government? Thanks for asking. Hinduism considers entrepreneurs and merchants and business people to be as low as the untouchables. When you're in Hindu, there's only anything as low as the untouchables is an entrepreneur and a merchant. Prime Minister Singh told his country in 1991, America admires their entrepreneurs. Not only do they put them on the low rung on the scale, We put them on a higher rung on the stool. They're wealth producers. They create. They think of ideas for the product. They manufacture the product. They package the product. They sell the product. They ship the product. They insure the product. You get it? Untouchables. And so Singh said in India, we're done with that nonsense. India has got to put that part of Hinduism behind us. We got to say enough is enough. We're not going to put down the entrepreneurs and so on. So Greek and Roman history did teach the world a lot. But oh, by the way, they all believed in both those societies of infanticide, killing children like crazy, had nothing together as far as sexual mores. It would be very hard for any of us to live in that kind of a culture. But I really appreciate the question. Next question.
Islam, fastest growing religion in the world. What kind of impact is that going to have on a capitalistic economic society?
It depends on which brand Islam is going to buy into. If Islam buys into the jihad and the rulership of the world, then we've got some difficulties. Because we have a group of people called the West, particularly the United States, that don't buy into that whatsoever. And so it's going to be a battle to the death. If Islam will calm down and get off their jihadi notions and live peacefully, and can they do that? For years, I would fly to Houston, and I would spend a day with Muslims. Everybody in the crowd, 500-600 people. They said, if you come, though, we want to do the prayer rug at 4 in the morning, and da-da. So, hey, I'll pray on the prayer rug. I'm a Christian, and I'll be praying to Christ. But that's what, fine, just keep your voice down. But I go, look, there are absolutely delightful Muslim, Islamic people on this planet. You and I as Christians know that they've got some fundamental things wrong. And that's why God put you and I on the planet. Oh, by the way, that's really why God put the Chinese on the planet. Why? There is no one that is having more of an effect on evangelizing the Islamic community than the Chinese. And when Wayne and I were over in Beijing, we asked many, many Chinese, why are the Muslims listening to you? And the answer is the color of your skin. It's the wrong color. And you're an American. And I got to tell you something. America is a fundamentally disliked, but it's just tremendous envy. The same way that I dislike Michael Jordan for stealing 3 world championships away from the Phoenix Suns. If it weren't for Michael Jordan, we'd have 3 championship trophies, and Jordan messed us up 3 different times. So in the same way that I envy him and dislike Michael Jordan, yet you and I both know that Michael Jordan was the straw that stirred the NBA drink. So we get it. So it is envy. But the world has enormous envy for the United States. So it's not just the Islamic people that have envy. But it is the whole world. Islam, here's what I'm going to do with that question. The reason why I'm going to pass that off to next week is for this reason. One of the things that we're going to be talking about next week, as we do focus on America and our number one ally in the world, Israel, I'll give you an assignment. And if you take me up on this assignment, when we see each other next Sunday, you'll say, Barry, that is... I am so glad you suggested those two books. But there's two books out right now. They're killer books. They are so dynamic. They're so, and they're both about Israel. The first book is by George Gilder. George Gilder, G-I-L-D-E-R is his name, George Gilder. And his book is called The Israel Test. The Israel Test. And the Israel Test is, are we going to hate these people because we're envious? Are we going to hate them because they produce 90% of the Nobel laureates and blah, 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 blah. Hate them. Or are we going to meet the Israel test and say they have been blessed in a special way by God and we will do our best to defend them from being wiped off the face of the earth by the jihadi Islam. So the Israel test, George Gilder, that's the first one. The other book is called The Upstart Nation. I'm telling you, you won't put it down, start to finish. You will not put it down to watch what 7 million people over in Israel are doing. I mean, they've got 5 times the economic startups as the United States. They have, you can take the wisdom of the world, and it's not doing what's happening in Israel, 7 million people. You're saying to me, what in the world was it that kicked off this Israel outburst? When Israel became a nation in 1948, they all banded together. They all came out of European communism. These were Jews that were from Eastern Europe. These were Jews from Russia. These were Jews, and it was all communism. So naturally, they made Israel into a pseudo-communist kibbutz, socialist, all for one for all, everybody's business is nobody's business. And finally, about 15 years ago, Israeli says, wait, we are entrepreneurs. This model doesn't fit us. And our best friends in the whole world are the United States. And when Jews are given a chance, we see exactly what they do. So that is called the Startup Nation. And I want to connect the Israel Test, the Startup Nation, those two books, the Startup Nation, with what's going on in the United States. And we're going to put that together. So I'll take the next question, please.
I have two questions. Can you describe the content in the book that you were holding, and is it available?
This book, The Index of Economic Freedom, is free to you. Go on. You can either come into my website, barryasmus.com, and go to the think tank, the National Center for Policy Analysis, and you can pull this off page by page by page. Or you can write the Wall Street Journal and pay, I think, $75 for this book. Wall Street Journal, and it's called The Index of Economic Freedom. The other book that I really, really, Wayne and I have just been using this because we just came from Peru. Hernando de Soto is from Lima, Peru. And Hernando de Soto, in Wayne and I's opinion, has written one of the most powerful books ever written. This one, The Mystery of Capital by Hernando de Soto from Lima, Peru. He's got the best think tank maybe in the world down there. We went and saw it. We spent the afternoon at De Soto's think tank. We had an absolute blast finding out what De Soto is all doing. And De Soto, this, but I'll give you just a thumbnail sketch on this. You travel the world and you see people that have housing, but they don't have a title to that housing. You travel the world and you see people that grow crops, but they don't have a deed to those crops. You travel the world and people have some small businesses, but they don't have articles of incorporation. If you don't have protected property rights, you're dead. 80% of the entrepreneurial startups in America come from a second mortgage on your home, but you can't get a second mortgage on your home without a first mortgage, and you can't get a first mortgage without a title, a deed. Details, details, details. And his subtitle of his book, Why Capitalism Triumphs in the West and Fails Everywhere Else. Why does capitalism triumph in the West and fail everywhere else? Bingo! Because capitalism has not been electrified. How do you electrify it? You've got to allow people to build up collateral. I mean, it's one thing to have a house, but if you don't have a title of that house, you don't have an incentive to improve it. Or let me just ask it this way. When was the last time that you washed a rental car? So next question, Ron.
Slowly give us the name of the first two books.
Okay, slowly give us the name of the Israel Test. The Israel Test. And that's by George Gilder. G-I-L-D-E-R. The Israel Test. George Gilder writes as well as anybody writes in the English language today. He's that caliber of a writer. When I read his book, Wealth and Poverty, in 1980, that's the only time I've ever canceled my economics class. I bought the book at the college bookstore. I was sitting in my car. I began to read it, and I couldn't give up. And I saw a student walk by. I rolled my window down, and I said, go to the classroom right on. Asmus is out today. Bye-bye. And I sat, and I read that book from 12 noon to 6 o'clock in the evening. 6 hours read that book. I mean, mesmerized. And Gilder is that kind of a writer. That book is called The Israel Test. The other one, and I don't know the two authors, they're both Jewish authors. And it's called The Upstart Nation. And it's really kind of interesting. George Gilder is not a Jew. But George Gilder says some of this is because of the innate talent of the Jewish people. I mean, for crying out loud, they are the Nobel laureates in economics across the board. They are the Nobel laureates in science across the board. They're the Nobel laureates in surgeons and musicians at Carnegie Hall. And Gilder goes on and on and on and on about the Jewish people. So it is very, very powerful. These guys that write the second book, The Upstart Nation, that's the name of it. The Upstart Nation, sorry, I don't have the L, but you can get it. The Upstart Nation. They're both Jews that wrote it. And they said, we disagree with George on that issue. We don't think it has much to do with the innate talent of the Jews. So that's kind of fun. So now they're going to take a different approach of why Israel is becoming an unbelievable miracle over there in the Mideast. And but they don't come from the innate talent of the Jews, but, and I'll let you read it. Ooh, you just salivate. It is so good. Okay, next question. Oh, back here and then up here.
Japan currently has around 200 to 250% of debt to GDP. We're going to come up on 100% in 2011, I believe, but yet Japan has low interest rates, and a lot of that is because Japanese are savers. We're not great savers. How long can Japan keep low interest rates, and do you see an interest rate crisis there?
As you know, Japan, an economic miracle 50 through 1990, through the 80s, an economic miracle. They, too, are very, very hard workers. They, too, are huge savers. You're exactly right. We are not savers. They are. But a labor-intensive manufacturing sector, as the Chinese are doing now, but certainly as manufacture, export, will only carry a nation so far. That is not the end all. Absolutely, it hits a limit. The Japanese hit a limit in 1990. The Japanese have been under recession for the last 20 years. The Japanese thought they could spend their way, it's called Keynesian economics, socialism, spend your way out of poverty into prosperity. And the Japanese have proved unequivocally it does not work, it won't work, it cannot work, and it hasn't worked. So now Japan has got itself in the dilemma of where their debt exceeds their GDP by 2 to 1. As he just said, our debt very soon is going to be 1 to 1. So when people say to me, is America ready to collapse? Is it all over? Is it the end of the ballgame? No, no, no. It's just this. We're at the precipice. As we move from half of the GDP debt to almost now 1 to 1 debt, we've moved our national debt up by $1.5 trillion just in the last year or year and a half. In fact, this president has added more to the national debt than all the 43 preceding presidents. presidents together. So I'm not trying to minimize what's going on. But even that, we only have debt that is about 1-to-1. We have about a $12-13 trillion debt. We have about a $12-14 trillion GDP, 1-to-1. Japan has proved that you do not collapse per se, even when you push this thing to 2-to-1. But you only get yourself more and more in a crisis. You're in a deep hole, and you think, how do I get out of this deep hole? I just dig deeper. Now, the thing that is truly saving the Japanese and the Chinese, they are both real saving countries. And that is cool, because you got to cover this kind of debt, and you cover that kind of debt with savings. Now, we have had no incentive to save, first of all. Secondly, we began to think that our main savings is going to come from our housing, because in 2000 through 2006 and 7, our savings was coming through our housing, and so we threw our whole hope in savings into our housing. That turned out to be a horrendous mistake. Our savings rate now is now up to about 6 or 8%. It won't be long, and America is going to be saving 8 to 10%. We will go back to the norms. And if somehow we can stop this spending nonsense and regain our breath, if somehow we can say that, no, we don't need a $1 trillion cap and trade. No, by the way, that's the mother of all socialism. I mean, cap and trade, we'll explain it next week, but cap and trade is socialism on steroids. Wait till you hear it. Cap and trade, terrible mistake. National health care, free health care, a terrible mistake at this point in time. And a tax increase that's coming up at the end of 2010, another terrible mistake. I know I'm off on next week. It's so hard not to want to jump to next week.
I know that you spoke about the continent of Africa, but could you talk just a little bit about what you know about the economy in South Africa now, since the end of apartheid?
South Africa went from being the only gem in all of Africa to turning into a prune and now a raisin. I got to tell you that when Mandy and I were in Cape Town, South Africa, we were with the man that owned 300 pick and pay pharmacy and pharmaceuticals, 300 of them. And the Africans have decided they want African managers for all of those stores. And they got it. And they're gone. In Kenya, they decide this magnificent hospital built by the Indians that is probably the most magnificent hospital in the world. In the world! But no, we're not going to let non-Kenyans manage this. We are going to put in a whole new manager. That hospital is closed, kaput, done, over, finished, gone. South Africa, a gem that's just wrinkling before our very eyes. It's not that Mandela and Mbeki wanted evil for South Africa. They are good men. Got to be with Mandela once. And how did you take it, being punished at Robben Island, sexually mistreated, physically mistreated? How did you take it? And he looks you right in the eye and says, bitterness is like drinking a glass. Bitterness is like drinking a glass of poison and then waiting for the other person to die. Forgiveness. What Jesus has taught me is forgiveness. The only thing harder than to forgive is not to forgive. And so Nelson Mandela forgave. Mbeki, the former president of South Africa, forgave. Do you and I as Christians really, really appreciate that? Yes, we do. Yes, we do. But you still have to do your economics correctly. Because good intentions are not going to be good enough. And what we're doing is we're taking property away from rightful property owners and giving it to people without skin in the game. And when you don't have skin in the game, everybody's business becomes nobody's business, and you don't manage that property the way they have to be managed. And so that's what I see in South Africa. It's just shrinking at a fairly rapid rate. He's coming. He's racing. Over here, Ron.
Concerning Ireland.
Concerning what?
Ireland.
Okay.
There are those that are arguing strongly that the reason for their economic success was that they invested in science and technology and built these big schools that created the people who could man the businesses that were started.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, if that is the answer for Ireland, that should be the answer then for India, because India has 7 or 8 or 10 of the best universities in the world, and yet India is still poverty poor. Those are nice things to do, but to be honest with you, when you're talking about bigger nations, and not that Ireland is all that big, how many people live in Ireland right now? 30 million or 60 million? Does anyone know Ireland's population? So it's sizable, but not huge. Believe me, many, many times that I have talked to Irish people of what they believe created the economic miracle, and very, very few understand that it was all taxes. They really don't. But I've got to be honest with you. Americans, 9 out of 10 Americans, do not realize that we had a fairly lousy 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. We had 5 lousy decades, 50 years that were not very good. We could talk about each one of those decades. They were not very good. Oh, by the way, in all 5 of those decades, we had 70% tax rates, 70% marginal tax rates. It started in 1932, and it carried all the way through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. We have 5 lousy, stinky decades. And then Ronald Reagan becomes president of the United States and says, I'm not an economist. I don't understand how the economy works, but I will tell you something. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with taxing people 70%. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with letting you earn a dollar and government thinks it's going to lay claim to 70 cents on that dollar. And Ronald Reagan says we're going to lower the marginal tax rate from 70 to 50 to 28%. And all of a sudden, from 1983 through 2007, we have 25 years of the best years that this nation and this world has ever seen. Because of taxes! But you ask 9 out of 10 Americans why, and they'll come up with everything under the sun as to why. But now, why would that occur? Because when you lower marginal tax rates, you are incentivizing everybody. From the guy that's shining shoes at the Pittsburgh airport, to driving cab in Atlanta, to the top entrepreneur of Apple or HP, you are incentivizing a whole society. And when you incentivize a whole society, great and good things happen. I'll end there. I'll pray. And I can hardly wait to be with you next week.
I just recommend a book.
Yes, sir.
It's called The Whole of the Gospel by Rich Stern, president of World Vision.
Oh, he's wonderful. Yeah, the whole of the gospel.
And the two things that hit me on that was 1 billion people in the world earn $1 a day or less, and 1.6 billion earn $2 a day or less. And so his whole thesis is, you know, how to minister to those people.
Well, that very question, why, look it. We're living in a world where half of the world's population makes less than $2 a day. We're living in a world where 3 billion people on the planet have never used a telephone. We're living in a world where that barefoot, following an ox cart, and uploading for a living instead of downloading for a living is still the way it's done. This is inconceivable. This is the 21st century. How can it be that you go to most places in Latin America and it is so poor? You go to so many places in Asia and it is so poor. You go to Africa and it's so poor. How can it be? How can it be? And in our tiny, eensy-weensy little way, we're trying to answer that question. It is a spiritual question, first and foremost. It's an economic question, and it's a governmental question. And we're going to address each one of those, the spiritual, the economic, and the government. And so, let's pray. Father in heaven, Pastor Darrell just got done preaching on listening. Help us to take to heart what he had to say this morning. And now as we talk about these issues, Father, I confess, for now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. For now, we only know in part, but then we shall know even as we are known. So, Lord, in so many ways, we're like blind squirrels trying to find a nut. And once in a while we find one and we think it's kind of cool. Lord, help us to understand that our main job is to trust in you with all our heart, to lean not on our understanding, but on you. And as we lean on you, in you, and through you, you will direct our paths, because you are speaking true truth to our hearts. Thank you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.